a nice miracle my wife or daughter hasn't walked in here and interrupted this before.
Well, if I'm taking up too much time, just let me know, too. Like, I don't want to be, like, monopolizing you, because I know you are a busy guy and you have a million projects coming up.
Yep. But I'm enjoying it, so...
Good. That's part of the joy of doing this show, is I kind of get a chance to talk to people and really get into the kind of the meat of the stuff. And I love comics, what can I say?
Great. It's just natural. Why don't more people read them? I don't understand.
I don't know.
People are stupid.
That'll be my quote. Why don't you read comics? Come on. Now, putting together the monograph, how did you, I guess you and Dan went through and kind of put the book together of what was to be included?
Well, Dan was the editor, and Helene Silverman, my wife, was the designer, and so it was kind of like in hand to a great extent. But I kind of just like served their, I mean, my power was just saying like, please, God, don't put that in there. And otherwise, I just kind of like watched what they did, and it kept changing in a way because it was such a big project. And Dan came over every year, every Friday for a year and went through boxes of stuff, you know, and really drug all this stuff out that he got excited about. Some of it I was hiding. And so, you know, that was, we went back and forth on some things. But basically, I don't, you know, it's a great, wonderful thing happening to me, so I'm just trying not to get in the way of it. And once it got to the end, and maybe I've read what was in print, maybe I would change a few things and be a little more delicate about things. Sometimes things are invisible until they're in print.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really like this to make my family happy, but, you know, but it'll be mixed. It'll be a mixed bag, just because it always is.
Yeah, well, and that's the interesting thing about it is... you know, there is so much differentness to it.
Yeah, well, that's probably the confusing part. But I think I'm hoping it'll be fun for people to go like, oh, my God, what have we just encountered now, you know, in this book? It's kind of like that. I was surprised that they spent so much time on my light show flyer idea, which I was happy about and was like, great, go ahead.
Well, how much time did you spend in San Francisco? Because you're saying you're visiting.
No, I've only visited San Francisco for just a few days.
Okay.
Yeah.
How, like, the light show flyers, very, for those that haven't seen them, they're very heavily influenced, I guess, by the psychedelic Fillmore.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I was in Texas, and I really was, like, at home going to church, and I wanted to run off and be a hippie, but, of course, I was too frightened. And or whatever, and or you know, I just wanted to, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm at the running away from home time. But anyway, that's what was happening. It's the most like exciting graphic event in my lifetime. Really, was Yellow Submarine and the hippie posters and Zap Comics and that era of stuff was pretty dynamite. And so my idea was I really like doing prototypes of things, and I like doing little things that might be bigger things. And so I had this idea that I would do a microcosm of what I liked about the 60s as kind of a ritual exorcism or invocation of the 60s. And the things I liked were light show flyers, psychedelic music, light shows, and, I don't know, M&Ms. And so I built this little theater in my studio, which had a flyer to advertise it, a little light show, psychedelic music, and it was kind of confusing. And there were M&Ms in there. And you remember when the hippies tried to levitate the Pentagon?
The yippies.
The
yippies. Indeed, yes.
Out, demon, out. Yeah. Out, demon, out. It was kind of like that. I knew it wouldn't restart the 60s again, but you just have to try to do it. You know? But only the good stuff about the 60s, not the bad stuff.
What kind of effect did psychedelics have on you?
Well, I took some LSD in 1973 that just blew my brains out for a year or so. And I did it again. Well, I did a smaller bit at first, and then like later I did more from the same barrel of Orange Sunshine or whatever it was. It had like probably strychnine and speed and God knows what was in it. But I just thought, wow, this is so far beyond Revelations. I'm not impressed anymore. It just was a giant, big budget, horrifying monstrosity. And it looked like television, and it looked like commercials, and that made it extra horrifying. Because I thought I might have some kind of organic God experience, but what I just found out was I had turned into a TV commercial about scrubbing bubbles and soap disinfectants.
Kind of a pop culture.
Yeah, I guess it was like I'd taken in all that television until I was just full of television. Or maybe that's really what's in there. You know, our brain is some kind of synthesizing thing. And when you're just seeing hallucinations that are completely synthesized, I mean, they're a really extremely high fidelity and quality.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there were all kinds of like neurotic, crazy things that went along with it. And I was already making a lot of art before that, and I think how it affected my art in a lot of ways was I saw a whole bunch of stuff that was really kind of beyond my powers, something to aspire to, but it was the wrong stuff to go for. And so I just had this kind of a sensory overload of a 500,000 images to not do, you know.
So it definitely had an effect, and it pushed you, I guess, away from a direction.
Well, it's kind of like also, but I couldn't really avoid it. I mean, I could try to avoid it, but it's just neurotic, crazy, you know. LSD and mushrooms and that stuff, it's shamanistic stuff, you know. And whether every, you know, suburban kid in America should take it, you know, I'm not sure every kid should, you know. And because it's extremely heavy, you know. Like for me, I'm not going to do bungee jumping. No, that's too heavy for me. It's easy for some people, and some people take LSD and they run around and they go, wow.
It's just like crazy. Candy for them.
Yeah, but for me it was like completely devastating, awesome, you know, life changing, not life changing, but whatever, it happened.
Did you read up much on like some of Leary's stuff, or like someone like Robert Anton Wilson, what they write about the effects of the LSD experience afterwards?
I read quite a bit before, and I read some things afterwards, and I read a thing by Leary one time that was about greeting demons on LSD. And it said, greet them as friends, and they'll effervesce and go away. And he was right.
Yeah.
That was a good thing, too, because if you start believing any of this stuff that's happening to you, then you start making moves, and all these moves are bad moves. And like, all the stuff that Jimbo is babbling in that Jimbo in Paradise book, Adventures in Paradise, when he's tripping, when that girl gives him the pill, that's all stuff from that acid trip, a lot of it. And there's one page that has these, like, little bees flying toward the viewer and flying away. And those are from a thing that Wayne White told me that he saw on LSD. And I felt like I'd seen it, too, so I totally ripped it off.
I'm just looking through my copy now. I'm trying to remember which style you're using then.
Oh, it's trying to be kind of a thick and thin style, but it really wasn't like the LSD, which was just like computer animation, you know, like really slick.
Hyper.
Yeah, you know, like movies are now.
Within your paintings, there's a, you have a couple of big themes. You know, back to that kind of the 60s, I guess, TV watching you, Godzilla, monsters like that, and also like that kind of that beach babe, you know, bikini look. What kind of influence do those kind of movies have on you, and what's it you're exploring in your paintings with those themes?
Well, I'm exploring like the cliches that people define themselves by, you know, and the things that we culturally inherit in the sexes, and it's kind of an alien viewpoint of humanity and humanity's foibles and so on. It's also apocalyptic, and that's where like the Godzilla stuff comes in. There's a big forces versus like, you know, it's like those dreams where you're like trying to hit someone and you can't like hit them very hard, or the dream, I don't know. So the medium is kind of like dreaming, so it's, I guess it's related to that. But kind of swept away thinking about it. So no. Ask me again. I got confused.
I think I asked too much stuff in the same part.
Okay.
Like Godzilla, like, I guess, what does he represent for you?
He represents something. Well, I loved dinosaurs when I was a kid. Anything about dinosaurs. And I still like dinosaurs, and I like that they're discovering them all the time. I was confounded by Godzilla. We lived across the street from a drive-in theater in Brownsville, Texas, and we could see the movies over there. And maybe I must have seen some Godzilla movies over there. But the thing about Godzilla was it's so phony. It's so extra phony, and it kind of leads you to theater if you're interested in it, because then you read about Japanese cinema and theater and kind of see it coming out of Kabuki and stuff. And rituals and parades and stuff like that. And then you're kind of aware of the conventions of illusion and falsity, which is, you know, what painting's kind of making something that's completely artificial. It's either convincing you of its visual veracity, or it's kind of tricking you into a world that can't possibly exist, you know. And so my worlds are more like the latter, in that they're these collage, cartoony spaces. But I'm trying to make them very much like daydreams, so I'm hoping that they're going to be familiar somehow. It's kind of like, oh, this is the daydream waiting room.
One of my favorite little Jimbo moments, I think it's one of the Zongo issues, is you have this one-page spread, these two dinosaurs fighting, And then the next page is the kid with the toy dinosaurs.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I thought the best show in the world would be if you just had super edited close-ups of kids playing with dinosaurs that followed the continuity of the dinosaurs and put really good sound effects made by kids with their voices with them, which has been done in some forms now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But strictly speaking, I haven't seen like the kind of car wrecks that kids do where it's like, yeah, right, the car goes off the edge of the table and then it spins a few times and then it flips over and then it hits the edge of the couch.
And that's kind of like what you do with the school bus.
Yeah, and that's what happened to the school bus. And that's what my comics are like. They really are referring to playing in the sandbox and the phoniness of it, and how kids, like, they'll start a thread and they'll drop the thread, or they won't follow things very far. I follow things a lot more, you know, way farther than that, but the impulse to play is kind of being referred to.
The influence of childhood is really important for you, it sounds like, in your work.
Well, I was really bored, you know, like, confused. When I had free time when I was a young artist, and you'd be looking for inspiration, like, oh, if I could only, like, you know, see the world a different way, or if I could, like, draw this and have some insight or whatever. But I kind of, once I finally realized, and it was through looking at pop art at the Cobra Group and various art movements, that, like, oh, you could look backwards at your childhood and try to re-explore that. So in some ways, when I was a child, I was the best drawer, and I did little adult-style drawings when I was really young, which impressed everybody, but I always liked the kind of kids' drawings that kids did that I could see on the next table better, but I didn't do drawings like that, so, you know, I'm trying to, like...
I guess that's what you're exploring with your with the Zongo stuff, was going more for that, just pushing and getting, I guess, as rudimentary as you could.
Yeah, and... Also, I think, for one thing, it really pisses some people off. I paid $250 for this, you know, or someone else would go like, wow, I think I could draw a comic.
I'll be honest, 16, 17-year-old me, when it came out, I didn't get it. I was like, oh, look, this is from the Simpsons people.
Oh, God.
They've been on glue. You
well,
know.
That's the horrible thing, is they forced that on the comic on all you guys. They tried to sell it to you.
Well, now best to expose to different things. I mean,
but what about the dirty litter in the back? Did that freak you out?
I don't think I got that far.
Okay, good.
But at that age, I'd already read Mouse, and, you know, I pushed myself forward, and, you know, I worked in a comic store from like 16 to 18. And,
well, cool.
I think I read Mouse when I was 14.
Wow.
So I got started as a young kid. One thing you do in a lot of the paintings when you're looking at, like, the monsters or the beach babes, is you'll do double-layered paintings where there'll be two different things in the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's from, like, 1984, 1985.
Yep.
Is that kind of more going back to, like, exploring the superficial?
Well, it's kind of like a lap dissolve in a movie. And it's kind of like information overload and cliches about that. At that moment in time that I'd done that painting, David Sally had completely claimed that thing, you know, which was done extensively in like probably the 30s and the 40s by the guy whose name I'm not going to be able to think of now. You know, like a guy that was around when Duchamp was around. Anyway,
I'll have someone that'll let us know.
Yeah, just bleep it in, like, cut it in with my voice, like I'm saying it.
I'll get the robotic voice.
Yeah, just tweak it in Photoshop. It'll be fun. But anyway, there's precedence for this. And when I was in school, we were doing this kind of superimposed imagery and excited about it. And then the Lower East Side thing happened, and then it was really claimed by this like group of guys on the Lower East Side. We're the superimposition guys. And so I still did it for a while, but then I kind of like thought, well, gee, this is kind of, I better go somewhere else. I must explore something that's not being so well explored right now.
And you definitely see that going through the book, is just seeing what your next step was. And that's, you kind of going more into the, I guess, childhood stuff with the two dinosaurs and the pixie land.
And that's where I'm really finding what I do at that point. I think before the 80s, I did all this kind of scratchy cubist stuff, And in the 80s in the art world, Neo-Expressionism happened, which was a giant worldwide movie of scratchy Cubist drive kind of stuff in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as Expressionism was kind of derived from Cubism. And so in a way, I just thought, like, gee, I'm part of this. I'm like, shouldn't I be part of this? And, you know, I explored it. And also, I'd been, like, corresponding with Bruno Richard and all this, like, mainly him and Pascal Dury, who inspired a whole bunch of other, like, dark, crazy drawers in France. And my work was getting darker from kind of like, you know, Bruno telling me to make it darker. Use more ink. Not enough ink. make it dirty sex. You know? But anyway, so those guys had an influence. But then the 80s arrived, and it's like, oh, what am I, you know, where am I? But when I finally, like, made my paintings really thin, that was from childhood memories in Brownsville about Mexican print jobs, like weird colors overlaid really thinly. And so I kind of found my way from that.
Yeah, there's one like the La Maravilla en Masacarada.
Yeah.
That totally probably massacred.
Well, I had no idea. It's just stolen from a Mexican comic book, La Maravilla en Masacarada, the Masked Marvel or something. That's a really cheap print that I sell on my website. It may be just because it's cheap, but that's the one people choose. And maybe it's just because it's like death fighting this big serpent. Maybe people like the whatever they read into it.
But it's definitely, I see, like, going through it while talking to you, it definitely gets a lot darker pretty much immediately following that. And I can see that kind of more angry. Not angry, but haunted.
Well, if you look at the stuff at the very first of the book, I'm painting the lines first. I'm painting black lines, and then I'm filling in the color in between. And I was always interested in printing and registration. And so by that time in the mid-80s, I figured out how to do the lines last. And it was really hard to draw it like freehand and have it work, you know, because you can mess it up a million different ways. But I figured out some really simple techniques so that I could draw it freehand and I could get it in the right place, or I could get rid of it within 8 seconds, you know, because it was acrylic. I wouldn't have long to get rid of it, but I figured out to have sponges and things.
It's quite interesting the difference that how you approach something can change, because I know Ralph Stem was saying when he teaches students doing drawing, one of his big things is start at the feet.
Oh, so they're on the ground.
So, you know, most people when they do something, they start at the head.
Oh.
And do that figure, but this, you're getting a different drawing.
Also, you're kind of getting a different drawing if you're remembering what you know about something. I mean, people think they can't draw anything, but if they were to sit with a piece of paper and their eyes closed and think about, like, what a dog nose looked like, and that it's divided the middle and it has two little nostrils and then the lip divides, if they would just, like, kind of make notes about what they know about a dog, I think they would end up drawing a dog in greater detail. I've lost my mind talking about this dog nose.
That's okay.
I got curious. I was drawing it in my mind, this dog nose.
Now, you're talking before about drawing outside of the line, not using the line, and that's something I find very interesting about a lot of your work, is you'll do things and it'll be little black splotches which make a shape.
Uh-huh.
Which I find, how did you develop into that style? Because it's very unique.
You mean the kind of smeary stuff? Or the dotty stuff, not the smeary stuff?
It's like, they're like, I don't know, like black shapes.
Well, it's just, you can draw value reductions, you know, and that would probably come more from 60s illustration in some ways. I think one thing that was really good for me was corresponding with Bruno, because he would encourage me to copy, you know, and they had some interesting strategies, you know, about, maybe it's a simple technique I just didn't know, but say if I'm going to draw something in front of me and I have a sketchbook open in two pages, you know, a left page and a right page, then in my mind I can draw a middle vertical line on the scene I'm looking at, and then that helps me orient on the pages of the sketchbook, like, you know, what's the center of the drawing, or then deciding, like, what's the edge of the drawing going to be, and then figuring out, like, how do you get from here to there in proportion. And there's just simple things you can do that really involved almost like imagined grids. And in my paintings, I use pieces of cardboard to indicate the grid, because drawing the grid was really ugly, and then you had to hide it or erase it or get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I figured out, I'll just cut pieces of cardboard that cover up everything except the area I'm looking at, and they don't have to draw the grid. And so I always have these pieces of, they're almost like big playing cards I'm laying down and taking up off the painting.
Does that change how you're drawing it as far as like blocking up everything you're looking at, so you're only focusing on a part?
Well, it actually helps me because I'm drawing each section freehand. If I'm trying to copy something, if I have a drawing and it's 10 inches across and then I'm trying to copy it 10 feet across, if I'm just freehanding it from one end to the other, the proportions are just going to go crazy. I just don't have the facility to, like, without any kind of mental mechanism, have it come out right. So if I'll just notate, you know, with like the tiniest of marks or a piece of tape or whatever, like where I am in the drawing, then it'll help me keep it in proportion. So it's almost like a simplification of an already simple sign painting technique.
Now, what's your preferred size working with?
Oh, gee. You mean paint-wise?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I have a real small place. I don't have a giant studio right now because I can't afford the rents over in Williamsburg. And I have it live in a big Victorian house, so there's a lot of room around here. But it's easy for me right now to paint on doors. And so I stretch canvas on hollow-core doors, and then I either paint half the door or a long door or any proportion of it, and then I take the canvas off and I order a panel for it and then restretch it on the panel so it's the right dimension as an object and everything. And when I was in my last giant studios, I was painting paintings that were like this anyway. So when I got here, I was like, oh my God, I won't be able to do what I want. And then I thought, I really just want to paint really horizontal paintings right now. So at some point, I guess I'll have to get some panels that are a little bit bigger, maybe if I want to do more vertical things. But, you know, your space you work in has an effect.
Mm. Look at someone like Dave Cooper. His stuff is just huge.
I've been in a studio. It's not a giant room. It's enough to get up, you know, like maybe six of those things on the wall at a time. Well, I don't know how giant he's painting right now, maybe. He was painting about maybe 3 by 6 feet or something.
Okay, that's huge for me.
Oh. Well, huge for me, the biggest painting I ever did was probably about 12 by 24 feet or something
Wow.
like that. But stretched paintings, you know, it's really a giant problem. If you're painting a painting that's over 6 by 8 feet, then you're kind of in trouble. But
yeah. I saw a couple, Jason McLean, he local Vancouver painter,
mm-hmm.
and he had a show of just some not-for-sale stuff, and it was, I think they're probably about 6 by 8, but they were I don't think they were on necessarily like stretch canvas.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, where are you going to put it? You have to find a door big enough for it to go through and so on. But I like painting stuff big, but I think there's a real thing. I'm sorry I'm saying I think every other second. And the art world is kind of consumed with gigantism in a way. The price of admission is making something so huge and time-consuming that people just have to go like, oh my God, it's almost as good as Chris Ware. we'll let him in the canon. Let him in.
Baby's on fire. Better throw her in the water. Look at her laughing like a heifer to the slaughter. Baby's on fire, and all the laughing boys are bitching, waiting for photos. Oh, the plot is so bewitching. Necessary for her learning. If you'll be my flotsam, I could be half the man I used to.
And he had you at a show in Phoenix.
Yeah. Okay. I went to Phoenix to lecture for that show, and it was a very nice show, nice people. And then when I got back, I said, Chris, why weren't you at the show? And he said, well, the only reason I curated the show, I'm sorry, Chris, for telling your secrets, but he said, the only reason I did the show is because I have a friend in Phoenix I wanted to go see. And so, but then they asked him if he was a good public speaker, and he said no. So they didn't invite him.
Oh, well, of course
crazy?
He's going to say no. It's Chris Ware.
I know, but he's a great public speaker. I mean, people flock around him like he's John the Baptist or something.
He was on to talk about Gasoline Alley with Jeet here, and he was, you know, kept saying, oh, sorry, I don't want to say too much because I'll leave it to Jeet, whose English is a second language, and he's saying it better than me. But he was fantastic.
So. Yeah, he's great. He's a wonderful person.
But it's a neat show looking at the stuff in it because it is quite a range because all of you... I guess the only... I see maybe some overlap between you and, like, say, Jerry Moriarty, but definitely, like... Maybe a little bit, like, Ron Rigi's definitely got some influence from you, but, like, between you and Kim Deitch, completely different. And, like, same with Seth.
Yep. Well, it's nice to have some variety in a show. Kim Deitch just, you know, his stuff, I love it, but it really scares the hell out of me. It has since I was in high school, you know, when I first came across that Sunshine Girl stuff, you know. He's fantastic. And Seth, you know, I think his model building is unreal. They had a whole section of his models that were fantastic.
Well, apparently his whole basement's filled with them.
Wow. So, that's impressive. My models are a lot smaller.
Right, and there's actually some pictures of some in the little matchbook models, right?
The ones I make?
Yeah.
The ones I make are, yeah, they're about a little bit bigger than HO scale, I guess.
I'm going to ask about the thing you did for Marvel, the Omega the Unknown.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's your first time doing something for Marvel, as you described it, the Death Star.
Yeah. I bet they didn't appreciate that. I'm hoping no one noticed that. But they were nice people. Everyone at Marvel was very nice to me.
It's I've heard the same description from other people. They go there and it's like a compound.
Yeah, they're comic fans, you know. They're making comics.
How did you get hooked into that? Was that the writer wanting your stuff in it?
It was totally Jonathan Lethem. It's just like if Spiegelman and Seth want me in something, I need to do it. And if Jonathan Lethem wants me to do something in his comic, then it's really good for me and fun to do. He's a writer I like. I'm a fan of his work. And he's also really into Philip K. Dick and lives in Brooklyn. And, you know, it was kind of, you know, just a crazy thing to do. I'll do five or six pages in a Marvel comic and a cover. It'll just be completely wrong in every way. But it kind of suited the situation he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to do the cover where really I did do it kind of in a style of the people who followed Kirby, and maybe I tried to maybe do it a little bit better than the people that followed Kirby who really followed him. The terrible Kirby, I think I tried to do a tiny bit better than the worst Kirby for the cover. So I wanted to kind of hark back to the 70s with it. But and so inside, the story I do is a story drawn by the Omega superhero to describe his origin. And so at first I was like, I think I had the idea that maybe Jonathan wanted me to draw it real scratchy and primitive. And then I decided, well, he's a superhero, so he can probably draw as good as I can anyway. So I just kind of drew it in a... I just allowed it to be spazzy, but I didn't try to make it perfect, you know, rougher or anything.
Was it more like some of the, like, I guess, like your 100, you know, 100 drawings? Like,
yeah,
some of that more formed?
Well, yeah, those are... they're inked with, like, a little... you know, a little Japanese dip nib, and this was inked with brush. That was the main difference. Yeah, the drawing would be kind of the same. I would just try to draw it, but I wouldn't unspaz it. And you can see on the cover, there's all those little goofy characters at the bottom, and that's what the story's about in the comic.
I had the guy that did the coloring for that, who's a cartoonist himself, Paul Hornsmeyer,
yep,
on a couple of weeks ago, and he's telling me about the process of trying to color the page, and it was just like, he apparently he's telling me he printed it out and tried doing it with crayon. He tried all these different things just to capture it right, because he's kind of awestruck with it.
That's kind of what I was going to do. For me, I can do color separations in the old-timey way, which is to put acetate overlays, mm-hmm, and draw each color in black. I can do that. But I just thought, oh my God, I'm going to spend, you know, 2 weeks doing this, and then they're not going to know what to do with it because it's not on a computer. So I just thought I better let him do it. But I just did, you know, I did silkscreen separations and stuff, so I still do that kind of stuff. But people at magazines, they don't necessarily know what that is anymore.
No. No, it's a lost art. One of my favorite cartoonists actually got trained in all the old typography ways but then he had to scrap it all.
Who was that?
This French guy, Michel Rebagliotti. Rebagliotti?
Mm. Tronin Quarterly's covered him. I know his work, but otherwise I might not know him.
Yep, he's the Paul Stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's very accomplished work.
I think, you know what? I'm going to end us here.
Uh-huh.
I feel kind of fulfilled.
Yeah, that was a lot of questions.
Yeah.
It was very nice.
I really thank you for taking the time with me today.
You're very welcome. I'll actually listen to some of these interviews sometimes. I didn't realize they were going to be like epics.
It's I get pretty into it. Normally, we do live interviews for an hour.
Uh-huh.
But certain people, I don't want to limit that. And you're one of those people where I wanted to be able to just have a conversation and just do it from there. Because sometimes I'll interview like a younger cartoonist and who doesn't have very much stuff. So, you know, an hour's plenty.
Right. Well, it's really nice. You know the material, and so it was cool.
Well,
cool for me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yep.
And I'll need music requests because this is on the radio.
Oh, so. You mean like a list of songs to play, or something, or one song, or what?
About 8 to 10.
Oh wow.
Yeah, because
you think you'd be able to. I guess with computers, you could probably find things now.
Oh, yeah. I've got... In my own collection, I have a lot of stuff, and also I can download anything.
Okay.
Don't listen, FBI. pick whatever you want. The world is your oyster. I even have a couple of your tracks kicking around, and some of those 7 inches that you did for Ralph and stuff. But, like I said, anything you want, just
pick. But I can just give you a list.
Yep.
Could you email me, and then I'll attach the list back to it?
Yeah.
And I probably have an email from you, but I don't know where it is.
No worries. I didn't. That'll be no problem.
Cool.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Thank you.
And I hope you have a swell evening.
Hey, we'll run into you sometime.
Hopefully.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. That was Gary Panter. Wow. I feel kind of stunned. That was fantastic. 2 hours. So thanks for listening, everyone. CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Studs.